This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Science News. We'll explore the latest research and the intersection of science and society. There's always something fascinating to learn in Science News, coming up next on the audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Science News, and I'm your reader, Bill Shaw, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the sciencenews.org website, copyright 2025, Society for Science and the Public. And now I'll begin with and our first article for today from the news of animals. Warm autumns could be a driver in monarch butterflies' decline. In lab tests, higher temps ended monarchs' reproductive pause during migration. By Jude Coleman. Toastier fall weather might cause migrating monarch butterflies to wing it and change their flight plans, starting the countdown toward death. Eastern monarchs captured during their autumn migration and exposed to warm temperatures in the lab came out of their usual reproductive hiatus. Evolutionary biologist Ken Fedorka and colleagues report August 12th in Royal Society Open Science. Breaking that hiatus means the butterflies will likely die sooner than they normally would. Quote, once you decide to go reproductive, your clock starts ticking, says Fedorka of the University of Central Florida in Orlando. In North America, monarch butterflies live about a month, but the last generation of the year, the ones that migrate south, can live around 8 months. This generation emerges in late summer in breeding grounds across the northern United States and southern Canada. The butterflies are born in reproductive diapause and fly up to thousands of kilometers south to overwintering sites. Come spring, the monarchs begin reproducing and then die, with subsequent generations migrating north again. Since the 1990s, monarch populations have dropped, particularly at overwintering sites. Populations found east of the Rocky Mountains have declined by around 80%. Higher loads of the parasite Ophryocystis electrocera could be contributing to the decline, as could be the loss of habitat. Milkweed, the flower on which monarchs lay their eggs and on which their larvae exclusively feed. Researchers also think that higher temperatures caused by climate change could be detrimental, but until now, no studies have specifically looked at temperatures' impact on diapause, says Karen Oberhauser, a conservation biologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who was not involved with the new work. Fedorka and colleagues collected nearly 500 butterflies from the wild just as the monarchs began their fall migration. In the lab, the butterflies were placed in mesh cages within a temperature and light-controlled incubator. Using 70 years of climate data, the team calculated the typical temperature ranges along the butterfly's migration path and exposed the butterflies to the higher and lower ends. One group experienced an incubator temperature averaging around 23 degrees Celsius, while the other group was subjected to about 19 degrees Celsius. After 26 days, the surviving butterflies were randomly assigned to either warmer or cooler overwintering conditions and monitored again. Many of the monarchs exposed to higher temperatures began breeding in the migration phase, leading to females laying eggs despite the lack of milkweed. Quote, these monarchs are ready to drop out of migration on a moment's notice, Fedorka says. A statistical analysis found that warm males had an 88% increase in the risk of death compared with those in the cold treatment. The warmer males that died also were in worse physical shape based on body weight divided by wing length. During overwintering, monarchs of both sexes that experienced a warmer migration phase had a 28% higher risk of death, regardless of the overwintering temperatures. The higher risk of death for males during migration and the lack of significant deaths in females could be a result of sample size or males' condition that year, Fedorka notes. The team says that further research is needed to show how the results apply in the wild. Even so, Oberhauser says, quote, it's an important piece of the puzzle in our understanding of how human activities will affect monarchs, end quote. Insect ecologist Sonia Altizer notes that the butterfly's propensity for abandoning their migration in warm weather means they could one day swap their fully migratory lifestyles for partial ones. And while monarchs do contribute as pollinators, the loss of their migration will also mean the loss of a fantastic feat of nature. Quote, it's an incredibly beautiful and amazing and rare phenomenon, says Altizer of the University of Georgia in Athens. Quote, if we lose these migratory populations, we can't just bring them back, end quote. From the News of Health and Medicine, the sugar substitute sucralose makes immunotherapy less effective. Sucralose affects the gut microbiome in ways that reduce the efficacy of this cancer treatment by Pehal Dahar. Patients with certain types of cancers who consume sucralose found in the artificial sweetener Splenda respond worse to immunotherapy compared with those who don't. Researchers report July 30th in Cancer Discovery, but supplementing diets with the amino acid agrinine might mitigate these effects, they say. The findings add to a growing body of research showing that the gut microbiome, the vast community of microbes living in our digestive system, plays a crucial role in how well cancer treatments work. In this case, sucralose appears to disrupt beneficial gut bacteria that help support immune function, including T cells, the mainstay of our immune system. Quote, what's in this new study is that sucralose is promoting a microbiome that has few of the beneficial bacteria and more of the not-so-useful ones, says Magdalena Plebansky, an immunologist at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, who wasn't part of the study. Quote, and that sucralose could potentially be negatively affecting T cells directly, end quote. Previous research suggested that sucralose affects immunotherapy, but the underlying mechanism had not been cleared to investigate further. Immunologist Abby Overacre and colleagues examined the gut microbiome in mice that were fed sucralose at levels equivalent to what humans might consume. Quote, artificial sweeteners reduced gut microbiome diversity, and along with that, reduced overall levels of arginine, says Overacre of the University of Pittsburgh. Quote, arginine is very important for immune cell function, especially in cancer, end quote. The mice had been bred to have the same types of cancers as the human patients. Those fed sucralose showed reduced responsiveness to immunotherapy, but mice given regular table sugar responded just fine, Overacre says. To see how this translated to humans, the researchers surveyed 132 patients with advanced melanoma or non-small cell lung cancer who were receiving anti-PD-1 therapy, a kind of immunotherapy that targets a pathway used by cancer cells to evade the immune system. Patients filled out detailed questionnaires about their diets, including the consumption of artificial sweeteners. Even small amounts of sucralose appeared to have an adverse effect on immunotherapy response. Quote, we identified a cutoff of approximately 0.07 milligrams per kilogram of body weight that segregated patients who did poorly compared to patients who didn't, says medical oncologist Diwakar Davar of the University of Pittsburgh and other of the study's authors. He notes that this level is well below the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's recommended daily limit for sucralose consumption, 5 milligrams per kilogram, or about 22 cans of Diet Mountain Dew for a 70-kilogram male. Despite the small quantities involved, Overacre advises patients undergoing immunotherapy not to panic by, quote, throwing away everything in your kitchen, end quote, adding an arginine or citrulline supplement, which boosts arginine is easy, she says. Clinical oncologist, pharmacist Andrew Ruplin is a bit more measured, noting that patients should discuss the implications of these findings with their oncologist to make appropriate decisions about supplementation. The, quote, data joins a growing body of evidence that the benefits and risks of immunotherapy may be altered by individual patient behaviors that were completely unknown to us previously, says Ruplin of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle. But he would like to see additional prospective human trials with larger numbers of patients and different cancers included before implementing the findings in treatment. The researchers hope to launch clinical trials to investigate whether supplements can improve both the gut microbiome and anti-tumor immune response in patients. They also want to look at the impact of other sugar substitutes on immunotherapy. And our next article, also from the News of Health and Medicine, new clues emerge on how foods spark anaphylaxis. In mice studies, molecules that help allergens cross the gut lining seem to be key. By Laura Sanders, severe allergic reactions can be swift and deadly. Two new studies of mice, published August 7th in Science, reveal a key step in this terrifying cascade. What's more, these findings hint at a drug to prevent it. Anaphylaxis is a life-threatening allergic reaction commonly triggered by insect stings, medications, and foods such as peanuts or eggs. After exposure to the allergen, a person's immune system can overreact, leading to swelling, trouble breathing, and dangerously low blood pressure. Once underway, these extreme reactions can be stopped with epinephrine, administered either as an injection or, as of 2024, a nasal spray. This hormone helps open airways and shrink blood vessels, among other actions, but it doesn't always work. Quote, epinephrine only treats anaphylaxis once it has already occurred, says immunologist Tamara Hack of Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. Quote, we need treatments to prevent this severe reaction before it starts, end quote. By studying mice that develop signs of anaphylaxis after repeated exposure to food allergens, the new studies identified a key signal in the gut that kicks off anaphylaxis. Molecules known as leukotrienes. In the gut, bits of food get ferried across an intestinal membrane to reach the bloodstream where they can trigger anaphylaxis. This outsized reaction comes courtesy of mast cells, protective immune cells that sense dangers, real or perceived, and prompt the body to respond. Leukotrienes, one study found, help regulate this ferry ride across the gut membrane. Quote, once we realized what pathway we were studying, it was also immediately obvious how we might be able to block it, says Stephanie Eisenbarth, an immunologist at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago and co-author of one of the papers. No transport, no anaphylaxis, the reasoning went, quote, unless there's a ferry that gets the food allergen across, the mast cells on the other side will never know that it was there and they will not respond, Eisenbarth says. Quote, they won't induce this anaphylactic response, end quote. Sure enough, a drug already approved for asthma called Xylutan did just that. Mice's reactions to a food allergen, peanut in one study, egg in the other, were diminished on Xylutan. These findings relate only to allergic reactions caused by food that gets to the gut. Stings and other allergens probably work differently. Injected allergens, for instance, didn't seem to rely on leukotrienes to alert the immune system, says Nathaniel Bachtel, an immunologist at Yale University and co-author of the other paper. That work also uncovered details about the specialized populations of mast cells that proliferate in the gut lining. The details of how allergens can trigger reactions are incredibly complex and still poorly understood, Bachtel says. But both studies point to leukotrienes as key steps in food allergen reactions, making the molecules worth more scrutiny. Quote, it's kind of a strange thing, and in retrospect, it's a little bit surprising to me that this pathway hadn't been looked at this carefully, he says. For now, Hack says, it's not clear how this process works in people, but there are good reasons to suspect that mice and people are similar. Quote, these data strongly suggest that it is worth conducting human studies, end quote. Eisenbarth, along with the study, Adam Williams and others, has a clinical trial in the works. The first step will be to test whether Xylutan affects how well peanut particles cross the intestinal barrier in people with allergies to different foods, says Williams, an immunologist also at Northwestern. In these preliminary tests, scientists will study people with allergies but not to peanuts for safety reasons. The necessary experiments will take time to complete, but Williams is optimistic. Quote, we are making progress faster now than at any point in the history of allergy research, he says. Quote, and so there's hope, end quote. And now we have a feature article from the area of life. Squashing the spotted lanternfly problem may require enlisting other species. Bats, fungi, dogs, and even trees could help curb spread of the invasive pest, by Aaron Garcia de Jesus. A beautiful menace is on the move in the United States. Polka-dotted red and gray winged insects are gliding along sidewalks, climbing on plants, and crawling up buildings. Spotted youngsters are leaping away to avoid a sticky end at the bottom of a shoe. Welcome to spotted lanternfly season, an invasive plant hopper native to parts of China, India, and Vietnam. Spotted lanternflies have been making their way across the mid-Atlantic and northeastern United States for more than a decade, and some studies suggest they could reach California in the not-too-distant future. A cache of eggs likely first arrived on a landscaping stone shipment to Berks County in Pennsylvania in 2012, but it wasn't until 2014 that the insects were first detected. As spotted lanternflies have spread with established populations in 17 states and counting, they have found plenty of plants to feast on, especially grapevines, sparking worries within the agricultural industry that some crops could be at risk. Quote, initially, when they first came into Pennsylvania, we had no idea what was going to happen, says Matthew Holmes, a quantitative ecologist at Temple University in Philadelphia. Quote, they were eating everything and they were feeding on all these different plants, end quote. Researchers have since learned that while spotted lanternflies do suck sap from many kinds of plants, few of these plants die, but the critters have a particular affinity for two. One is Tree of Heaven, an invasive tree originally from China that arrived in the United States in the late 1700s and is now widespread in many parts of the country. The other is Grapevine. Quote, if you like wine, if you like grape juice, if you like eating grapes, that's where I think the impact is going to be, Holmes says. Large infestations can kill grapevines, so grape-growing regions that are still spotted lanternfly free, including California, Washington, and western Pennsylvania, are on high alert for the bug's invasion. Stomping spotted lanternflies on site has become a popular activity among city dwellers as the insects roam sidewalks. The plant hoppers are also susceptible to many insecticides, but lanternflies hanging around in unsprayed vegetation surrounding vineyards can move in when the pesticide wears off. Quote, nobody wants to put a lot of pesticides out there, says Flor Acevedo, an entomologist at Penn State. The chemicals are useful for protecting crops, but should be applied only where necessary because they can affect more than just the pest bug, she says. They're, quote, not good for anything. They're not good for the environment. They're not good for other organisms. They're not good for us, end quote. Probing the spotted lanternfly's biology and its interactions with other species is revealing other ways to keep its spread in check. As researchers map where spotted lanternflies might pop up next, natural predators and pathogens are among the tools that scientists might harness to curb the spread and damage to vineyards, targeting Trees of Heaven. Tree of Heaven and spotted lanternflies are thick as thieves, and controlling one could help control the other. Spotted lanternfly season officially begins in late September. That's when eggs, late in the fall, begin to hatch, releasing small, black-spotted nymphs. Over the next months, nymphs feed on sap from more than 70 plant species and grow into teenaged forms called fourth instars as their red stripes appear. Winged adults typically emerge in late July and feed voraciously until fall when they lay eggs in the first frost of the season, kills any surviving adults. And the adults come on fast. Quote, you'll see one or two adults, then all of a sudden, you'll just see them everywhere, says biologist Aaron McHale of Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Quote, and they're hitting you in the head as they're flying by, it's crazy, end quote. Where spotted lanternflies were first detected in Pennsylvania, their preferred food source, Tree of Heaven, was, quote, just everywhere as a weed tree in between flowers, fields, in the ditches, says Ann Hajek, an entomologist at Cornell University. With food so readily available, quote, it was really easy for the spotted lanternflies to increase without people even noticing, end quote. The pests consume sap from not only Tree of Heaven and grapevines, but also mape, birch, and black walnut trees. It's unclear how feeding on plants not found in their native range in Asia might affect lanternfly reproduction, Acevedo says. Studies show that eating grapevine sap alone, however, probably isn't the key to spreading widely. Spotted lanternfly nymphs feeding exclusively on three different kinds of grapes can still make it to adulthood. Acevedo and colleagues reported in the June Environmental Entomology, but fewer survived than those given mixed diets that included Tree of Heaven sap. Those surviving adults also lay fewer eggs. The findings suggest that culling Tree of Heaven from the area around vineyards, effectively removing lanternfly's favorite food source, could help protect crops. But whether removing Tree of Heaven will help is up for debate. It's also possible that the trees might serve as bait, pulling spotted lantern flies away from grapes, Acevedo says. Trees treated with insecticide could be, quote, living traps and, quote, killing nymphs and adults when they cluster on the trees. Experiments removing Tree of Heaven from infested vineyards could help researchers figure out which method, removal or bait, works better. It's also possible that there are other plants growing in the United States that are as good for lantern flies as the Tree of Heaven, Acevedo says. If such a plant exists, it might serve as a replacement food source, quote, but so far, based on what we see in the field, lantern flies really, really like Tree of Heaven, end quote. Tracking spotted lanternfly spread. Staying one step ahead of spotted lanternflies to protect grape-producing regions is a crucial, albeit astounding, tough task. The bugs haven't yet invaded major grape regions, including California or Washington, Helma says, though the species, quote, really is sort of knocking on the door of the Lake Erie grape belt, end quote, in western Pennsylvania and New York. Without preventive management, spotted lanternflies could become established in California by 2033, researchers reported, June 2022 in Communications Biology. But such predictions are often less about the specific year and more about where the plant hoppers have a high chance of turning up. That's because spotted lanternflies aren't slowly diffusing across the landscape. Quote, it's these random jumps, Helma says. Quote, and those random jumps are all driven by the random things that people do, end quote. Spotted lanternflies often lay eggs on tree trunks, but their eggs also make their way onto trains, cars, and shipping pallets, helping transport the bugs to new places. Some states, such as New Jersey, have implemented quarantines, meaning businesses need permits to move equipment and goods, and people should inspect cars for spotted lanternfly hitchhikers. But egg masses look like gray smears, and can be hard to find. Quote, we can see the adults and nymphs quite well, says Sally Dickinson, an animal behaviorist at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg. Quote, we can go on a crusade to kill all that we can see, and that's probably not going to make a dent in the population, end quote. Dogs' powerful noses, however, can help find eggs hidden in concealed spots. Trained detection dogs have proven useful for finding spotted lanternfly eggs on farms and at shipping ports, but there aren't enough dogs to meet the needs for surveillance everywhere. Volunteer dog handler teams can also effectively find eggs, suggesting that people may be able to turn to their own pets to help hunt down spotted lanternflies. Dickinson and colleagues report July 16th in Peer J. Quote, this is a proof of concept that we don't have to be employed in doing all of the fancy stuff with all the fancy gear, Dickinson says. It's possible that dog and human pairs could one day earn a badge or certification to help hunt down spotted lanternflies or other species. Tracking where nymphs and adults are making inroads is another way to tell when protective measures are needed. Using paint rollers to collect environmental DNA from Trees of Heaven or rounding up ants that consume the sap feeder's droppings could pick up hints of spotted lanternfly DNA before infestations get large. One technique uses computers to identify individual insects, which could help find exploding populations. Spotted lanternfly wing patterns are unique, researchers reported February 2023. 3 in Frontiers of Insect Science. Helmus and colleagues have tested such, quote, wing printing, end quote, in the field, using thousands of photos from around Temple University's campus to track insects' movements across trees and estimate how many are hanging around. Knowing population size could help farms and vineyards figure out how treatment options, such as whether to use insecticide and how much. Quote, if there's only 200 lantern flies out there, end quote, lots of insecticide might not be necessary, Helmus said. Quote, but there, if there's 20,000 out there, then that's a really big deal, end quote. Finding lantern fly predators and pathogens. Invasive species typically benefit from a lack of predators, but spotted lantern flies may finally be meeting theirs. Some birds have been reported chowing down on spotted lantern flies as having some predatory arthropods, including spined soldier bugs. Bats seem to be adopting a new diet as well. Rutgers biologist McHale initially thought that lantern flies were mostly active during the day, but while catching and releasing bats as part of a research project, she and her team would return to campus around 3 or 4 in the morning to find the insects climbing up and down building walls. Quote, that sparked a question in my mind. Maybe bats are also eating lantern flies, McHale says. Quote, how cool would it be to show that bats are now incorporating these guys into their diet, end quote. Genetic material extracted from big brown bat and eastern red bat guano in New Jersey showed that the animals are consuming spotted lantern flies. McHale and colleagues reported in Forests in February. The finding suggests that not only might bats help reduce lantern fly populations, but that probing guano for genetic material could also help researchers on the lookout in areas where lantern flies have yet to spread. In the spotted lantern flies native range in China, a fellow insect is on the prowl. There, the parasitoid wasp, Anastatus orientalis, lays its eggs inside those of spotted lantern flies, preventing them from hatching. The wasp may have helped control spotted lantern fly populations in South Korea after the invasive insect swept through the country in 2004. Wasps might also help in the United States, though not A. orientalis or A. bifasciatus, a related wasp from Europe. The wasps attack not only spotted lanternfly eggs, but also stink bugs and many other plant hopper relatives native to the United States. Instead, researchers need to find a wasp that kills spotted lanternflies without too many native casualties, says Mari West, an entomologist at the University of California, Riverside, and who also works with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Among the most promising candidates is Dryinus cyanicus, another wasp native to China that lays its eggs inside nymphs. The USDA is currently testing whether it has any effect on native plant hoppers, West says. Also under consideration is A. reduvi, a wasp found across North America. A. reduvi attacks lanternfly eggs at high rates, West and colleagues reported in the January Biological Control. Quote, because it's already native here, we might expect less of an impact to our native plant hopper or other insect species, West says. It's not just animal predators that have spotted lantern flies in the crosshairs. In October 2018, Cornell entomologist Hadjik and colleagues discovered dead adult lantern flies littered on the ground or attached to trees in a wooded area near an apple orchard in Reading, Pennsylvania. Two common fungal pathogens, Becota major and Bovaria bassiana had caused a major die-off, the team reported in proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2019. The fungi that infected the plant hoppers are found in soils across the United States, and that makes them an attractive bioinsecticide, Hedrick says. Quote, it's not like a synthetic chemical insecticide that can have an unwanted impact on lots of things, on lots more things in the environment and humans, end quote. Many other fungi also affect spotted lanternflies, though it's unclear whether any might make good bioinsecticides. B. bassiana, which coats insect bodies in a white fuzz, is already commercially available to control plant pests, including thrips and aphids, in field tests at a Pennsylvania park. Mycoinsecticides using the fungus killed nearly half of fourth instar nymphs and adults after 2 weeks. Hajek and colleagues reported in 2020 in Environmental Entomology. More than 90% of insects died after 9 days when the bioinsecticides were applied directly to adults hanging out on potted grapes. The other fungus, B. major, is not easy to mass produce. But if researchers find a way, it could cause a lot of damage. The fungus sends infected lanternflies climbing up trees or other vertical surfaces where fungal tendrils anchor its victim to the surface, killing the insect and shooting off spores. B. major, quote, caused a whole lot of infection in the spotted lanternfly population in the 2018 outbreak and basically took out the population. Hajek says, quote, that's pretty exciting, end quote. And an article from the News of Materials Science. Scientists recreate a legendary golden fabric from clam waste. The revival of sea silk offers a sustainable twist on an ancient textile by Selena Zhao. Shimmering like spun gold, sea silk fabric is so lustrous that some believe it inspired the Greek legends of Jason's quest for the Golden Fleece. For centuries, artisans in the Mediterranean have passed down the art of spinning the silk, which comes from the beard-like tufts of the giant clam, Pinna nobilis. But the clam's endangered species status has made it hard to keep the tradition alive. Now, scientists have recreated the legendary fabric using discarded parts of Atrenna pectinata, a related clam species farmed extensively in South Korea for food. They've also identified the precise molecular structure and formation behind sea silk's everlasting golden hue. The researchers report July 29th in Advanced Materials. Quote, so much of this species' fiber is thrown out as waste when it could be used as a new source of sea silk, says Dong Su Huang from the Pohang University of Science and Technology in Korea. Quote, if we collect it instead, we may open a new branch of sustainable luxury, end quote. Sea silk has long been made from the giant clam, P. nobilis, which is native to the Mediterranean and can grow up to 4 feet long. The earliest known mention of the silk dates back to the 2nd century when Tertullian, a Carthaginian lawyer turned Christian writer, described it in De Palio. Quote, nor was it enough to comb and sew the materials for a tunic. It was necessary also to fish for one's dress, for fleeces are obtained from the sea, where shells of extraordinary size are furnished with tufts of mossy hair. End quote. The silk comes from the clams, byssus threads, wispy but thick threads that anchor it to seaweed, sand, and stone. Traditionally, the threads are carefully harvested and rinsed in seawater to remove seaweed and sand, then washed with soft water to draw out salt and left to air dry. Next, the fibers are meticulously combed to enhance their glossy sheen and spun on wooden spindles. After being soaked in lemon juice for 24 to 36 hours, a final round of washing, drying, and combing concludes the process. The resulting sea silk is, quote, fine as children's hair, says Felicitas Mader, a researcher at the Natural History Museum of Basel in Switzerland. Quote, a glove would feel like nothing at all, says study co-author Jimin Choi, a biological engineer also at the Pohang University of Science and Technology. But since 1992, the European Union has banned the harvesting of P. nobilis, and following a massive die-off, it was officially classified as endangered in 2019. Then Huang and his team had discovered that the threads of A. pectinata, a closely related clam, shared striking physical and chemical similarities to the endangered species. And importantly, A. pectinata is already widely available in Korea. Quote, whenever you go to a seafood restaurant or Costco in Korea, most of the scallops you're eating are A. trina, Huang says. Importantly, the byssus of A. pectinata is usually discarded as waste. To Choi and Huang, this was a perfect opportunity for upcycling. When they replicated the traditional sea silk production process, they successfully created golden threads from A. pectinata that were virtually indistinguishable from those of the endangered P. nobilis. This came as no surprise to Mader, who has spent decades collaborating with Mediterranean sea silk artisans to piece together the fabric's history. One weaver, Ariana Pintus from Carbonia, Italy, had already independently discovered A. pectinata threads could work just as well, Mader says. The researchers also uncovered what gives sea silk its shimmering golden hue. Unlike most animal-based fibers like wool or silk, which are made from long, fibrous proteins, the team found that sea silk is primarily composed of spherical proteins called photononins. These globular proteins assemble into nanofibrils that twist together in helical bundles. Like butterfly wings or soap bubbles, the shimmer arises from how light reflects off nanostructures in untreated byssus. Iron ions mask the effect, but a soak in citric acid, the lemon bath, removes the iron, clearing the way for the golden hue to emerge. Because sea silk's golden luster comes from pigment rather than structure, the color, quote, doesn't fade for more than 1,000 years, Choi says. Globular proteins are typically unstable, Huang says, but in sea silk, photonins are reinforced by a mesh of sugars and matrix proteins that provide additional strength and durability. The more ordered the protein structure is within the fibers, the more brilliant the structure color becomes, the researchers note. These findings could not only help revive sea silk production, but also engineer non-toxic golden pigments for use in textiles or cosmetics, Huang says. Quote, I'm hoping maybe someone in Louis Vuitton may see our work and contact us about sending a sample, end quote. From the news of planetary science, a giant planet may orbit our closest sun-like neighbor. The Webb Telescope spotted the planet candidate near Alpha Centauri A. by Mackenzie Perlman. A sun-like star next door called Alpha Centauri A may host a huge planet, researchers report in two studies in press in astrophysical journal letters. The planet candidate orbits in its star's habitable zone, where liquid water could exist on a body's surface, although the object might be a gas giant that cannot support life. At about 4.3 light years from Earth, Alpha Centauri A and its sibling star, Alpha Centauri B, are the closest stellar neighbors that resemble the Sun in mass, age, and temperature. These dance partners orbit one another while a third star, the red dwarf, Proxima Centauri, circles the pair from afar. Proxima Centauri is the only star that hosts confirmed planets within this three-star system. Alpha Centauri A's proximity to Earth makes it, quote, an exceptional target for planet searches, says Caltech astrophysicist Aniket Sanghi, who submitted the papers about the potential discovery to arxiv.org on August 5th. But orbiting objects are hard to detect around the star. Nothing has been seen passing in front of it and dimming its starlight from the perspective of Earth or space telescopes. A newer search technique aims to directly image potential planets, but Alpha Centauri A's light can outshine that from any orbiting companions, and the partner star's glow interferes as well. So Sanghi and colleagues use the James Webb Space Telescope to spy on Alpha Centauri A's habitable zone in infrared light, since any cool planets there should strongly emit these wavelengths in August 2024. JWST, which sees in a wider range of infrared light than past telescopes, snapped images while a coronagraph instrument blocked most of the host star's light. A computer program later removed remaining glare from both sun-like stars. The observations revealed a potential planet near Alpha Centauri A at about twice the distance between Earth and the Sun. Combining JWST's view with older data from the Very Large Telescope in Chile helped the researchers estimate that the planet candidate travels an elliptical orbit, reaching roughly the distance between Earth and the Sun at its closest point to the host star. They also calculated that the object has a mass comparable to that of Saturn and is similar in size to Jupiter. That huge size hints that the purported planet might be a gas giant whose atmosphere likely can't support, quote, life as we know it, Sanghi says. Moreover, if confirmed, the big planet's gravity would dominate Alpha Centauri A's habitable zone, kicking out any Earth-like planets, quote, much like a bowling ball clears its pins, end quote. Two follow-up searches with JWST in 2025 failed to find the celestial body. That isn't surprising, Sanghi says. Computer simulations suggested the object was at a point in its orbit where it was too close to the host star for JWST to see it during the later attempts. Sanghi and colleagues suspect that the planet candidate takes a two-year trip around Alpha Centauri A, so they plan to set JWST sights on it again in August 2026 to help verify its status. While astrophysicist Eric Agal commends the team's work, he remains cautious and emphasizes that it's too early to call the object a planet. Quote, I have seen planet candidates come and go, says Agal of the University of Washington in Seattle. But if validated, quote, this is the best case we have for detecting and characterizing a habitable zone exoplanet around sun-like stars in our entire galaxy, end quote. The work represents a larger change in exoplanet searches and helps pass the torch to direct imaging, says MIT astrophysicist Sarah Sager, who was not involved in the new studies. Quote, "I'm confident we're going to look back in the future and say this was the start of a new era," end quote. And now our last article for today from the News of Physics. Sunlight is all that's needed to keep these tiny aircraft aloft. The devices could measure weather in Earth's neglected upper atmosphere, by Emily Conover. Earth's mesosphere is a, quote, no-fly zone, end quote. The air in this layer of the upper atmosphere is too thin to support traditional aircraft, but new lightweight devices could defy that rule, requiring only sunlight to keep them aloft on high. The technology is based on photophoresis, the flow of gas generated around an object when light shines on it. This effect is particularly strong at low pressures, as in the mesosphere, which sits 50 to 85 kilometers above Earth's surface. Aircraft designed to harness this principle levitated in laboratory conditions that mimicked the mesosphere. Physicist Benjamin Schaefer and colleagues report in the August 14th Nature. The technique could help scientists unlock the secrets of the mesosphere, which is so poorly understood. It's known as the, quote, ignorosphere, end quote. Just a centimeter wide, the flyers weigh less than a milligram. Cradling one in your hand feels like holding nothing, says Schaefer of Harvard University and Rarefied Technologies, a startup in Albuquerque, New Mexico, developing the technology. An errant sigh could send it sailing from your palm. Quote, if you sneeze, you might as well say goodbye, end quote. The design consists of two thin layers of material stacked atop one another, perforated by channels that allow gas flow like two slices of Swiss cheese. The top layer is transparent while the bottom layer absorbs sunlight. This produces a temperature difference that sends gas streaming from the top of the device to the bottom, generating an upward force. Similar mesosphere surfers have been studied previously, but the new devices generated the largest lift forces for their weight of any tested so far, Schaefer says. The researchers estimate that a device with a 3-centimeter radius could hold a 10-milligram payload that could make simple measurements and communicate with the ground. The devices could provide data on wind speeds, temperatures, and pressures in the mesosphere. Or the craft could explore an even more challenging environment, the thin atmosphere of Mars. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Bill Shaw with Science News. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.